You're listening to another podcast. A podcast not only of reviewing and discussing, but of discovery. A deep dive into a classic show whose influence is immeasurable. Your next stop, Anthology. Hello and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and if this is your first time listening, Anthology is a podcast where I review The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer and other classic and contemporary science fiction anthology series. For archives of all of my episodes, visit AnthologyPod.com. You can also like the Facebook page at Facebook.com/AnthologyPod and follow me on Twitter at OVAnthologyPod and on all the other social medias at ObsessiveViewer. You can also subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer Podcast's YouTube channel, where I'm posting more video content, including occasional video versions of my podcasts, and that's also where I live stream the occasional podcast episode recording as well. And finally, if you're interested in starting your own podcast, you can sign up to host it through Libsyn, which is where I've hosted all three of my podcasts for over a decade now, and get up to 2 months free with the promo code OBSESS. More details on that are in the show notes of this episode. Those show notes can also be found at anthologypod.com/104. So today on the show, it is the final installment of my Between the Seasons episodes in the lead up to season 4 and in the aftermath of season 3 of Anthology. I'm bringing on guests to talk about other things, like I had last time I had Victor Gamboa for the big crossover episode with the Outer Limits podcast. And before that, I had a season 3 wrap-up episode with Brandon Cruz from Submitted for Your Approval. And today on the show, we're continuing the tradition of having a review of a Rod Serling related work, and I will be joined by my co-host from Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies podcasts, Tiny, to talk about the 1956 film adaptation of the teleplay of The Rack, which the movie version was filmed and directed by Arnold Lavin and starring Paul Newman. That's coming later in the episode, but first I'm going to do a solo review of the 1955 United States Steel Hour episode, The Rack, which was written by Rod Serling. So that is coming up here in a moment, but let's talk about some things from the world of fiction and science, which is the section of the podcast where I basically say anything about science fiction that has happened recently or is on my mind, basically, or something that I've watched lately as I scratch my nose on camera. So a couple of things. A few weeks ago, there was A24, basically in honor of Civil War coming out, which is excellent, by the way. I reviewed it on this week's episode of Obsessive Viewer. In honor of that coming out, A24 brought back some of their movies for one night only, I believe, in theaters, and I had the opportunity to see Ex Machina, which is one of my favorite movies, and I have like a list on Letterboxd where I have a list of my favorite movies of all time that I have not seen in a theater yet. And I have not seen Ex Machina in a theater, so I was so excited to see it. And then just mental health stuff. Like, I had just a bad, just like bout of depression that day. And I couldn't bring myself to go to the theater. And I'm really bummed about that, but it is what it is. It happens. So hopefully it's re-released in theaters, at some point. But, the consolation of that is that I really liked Civil War. Alex Garland's Civil War, it's speculative fiction. It's not, well, it's near future. View of a civil war in the US, and it's riveting, it's thrilling, it's shocking, it's provocative, but not in a socio-political, like modern social commentary kind of way. It's more about tone and atmosphere and kind of the macro of it. It's really, really fascinating. There's a lot of really good subtext to it that I think worked really well. So Civil War, it's in theaters now. I reviewed it on episode 424 of the Obsessive Viewer podcast. Elsewhere from the world of fiction and science, I want to talk about two movies that I watched on Criterion Channel. I can't remember if I mentioned this in previous episodes. I don't think I did. I hope I didn't. But two real quick ones. Criterion Channel had a post-apocalyptic sci-fi category. I don't know if it's still up or if they still have like multiple entries from that. But two movies that I saw from that were really, really great were Testament from the 80s, Testament and Ikari XB1. I may have talked about Ikari XB1 in a previous episode, but Ikari XB1 is incredible. It's a Czechoslovakian sci-fi space movie. It is kind of the prototype for a lot of science fiction space epics. Kubrick took a lot of inspiration from it for the physical or for the visuals for 2001: A Space Odyssey. You can see a lot of that, the skeleton of 2001 in that. And also in terms of story, there's a lot that can be mined from it that influenced a lot of science fiction going forward, space opera science fiction, I should say. And then Testament is an incredible post-apocalyptic 80s horror movie where it's a family that basically an atomic bomb is dropped. Like there's nuclear war breaks out and this small family is just confined to this one town. And it's just this weird slice of life thing where it's just this family struggling to survive. The father has gone missing. He was in town when he was in the city when the bombs fell, and he just, there's no resolution to what happened to him or anything. And it's just the mother trying to raise her kids in this nuclear holocaust. And it is, there are moments in this movie that will stick with me for, if not the rest of my life, at least for many years to come. There's one in particular that was just quietly devastating in the most gut-wrenching, just tragic sense of the term. It's incredible. Testament. I watched it on Criterion Channel. Check it out. I also reviewed those on my Patreon, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. So that's from the world of fiction and science. Let's go into my likely brief review of United States Steel Hour, season 2, episode 16, The Rack, which aired on, I believe it was NBC at the time. According to Wikipedia, U.S. Steel Hour was on, yes, so it was on, well, actually, I don't know, because this was in 1955. It aired on April 12th, 1955. My source says that U.S. Steel Hour aired on NBC from 1949 to 1953, so after that, I don't know what network it was on, but The Rack aired on April 12th, 1955. It was written by Rod Serling. The plot summary is: a decorated Korean War hero inexplicably collaborates with the enemy while interred in a POW camp and is court-martialed. A director for this episode of the U.S. Steel Hour was Alex Siegel. He would go on to direct an episode of Bob Hope Presents the Chrysler Theater called A Killing at Sundial, which was written by Serling. The premise of that episode is: a Native American seeks revenge on the man he holds responsible for his father's lynching. And Alex Siegel also directed a TV movie titled Certain Honorable Men that was written by Serling and aired on September 12th, 1968. That plot summary for Certain Honorable Men is: the protege of a powerful congressman discovers his boss's corruption. As mentioned before, this teleplay of The Rack was written by Rod Serling, and it is available in its entirety on YouTube, courtesy of, I think it's like UCLA like arts or something. I can't remember exactly what it is, what the institution is, but it's like I'm about to find it here, I promise. So it is the UCLA Film and Television Archive. So they have it up on YouTube in its entirety, including act breaks and ads, sponsored ads and everything. It's pretty interesting. It's a good piece of television history there. Starring in this episode of U.S. Steel Hour is Wendell Corey as Captain Sam Moulton. Why do I have him top billed? That's interesting. Wendell Corey appeared in an episode of Climax called To Wake at Midnight, which was written by Serling and directed by John Frankenheimer, that aired on June 23rd, 1955. He also appeared in The Arena, which was an episode of Studio One that was written by Serling and aired in April of 1956. Co-starring as Steve Wasnick is Keenan Wynn, who appeared in the Playhouse 90 version of Requiem for Heavyweight, which I reviewed in episode 22 of this podcast. And he also appeared, of course, in the season one finale of The Twilight Zone, A World of His Own, which I reviewed in episode 31 of the podcast. Arguably starring, I don't know why he's third billed in my list, as Captain Edward Hall Jr. is Marshall Thompson. This was his only time working with anything related to Serling that I could find. And rounding out the cast as Edward Hall Sr. is Nicholas Joy, who appeared in an episode of Lux Video Theater in 1953 titled The Inn of Eagles, which was written by Serling. And he also appeared in a 1954 episode of Studio One called UFO that was written by Serling as well. So a bit of trivia I have for this episode of television is that Rod Serling apparently took 19 months to complete the teleplay. Now, I got this from the trivia page for the movie version that I'm going to be reviewing later in this episode with Tiny. But by all intents and purposes, I believe this is referring to the teleplay that Serling actually wrote, because the script for the movie was obviously adapted from Serling's teleplay. So the trivia says Rod Serling took 19 months to complete the teleplay, the longest he ever spent writing a single screenplay. It also took 7 rewrites to get to the final version, the most of any of his screenplays. And those numbers, that data, those statistics are staggering to me because of how prolific and quick he was to write and turn around scripts for The Twilight Zone and for any other project that he did. So like him taking 19 months to complete this teleplay in particular is pretty staggering. And it really comes through in the finished product because it's really well done. I'm going to talk about it a bit more with Tiny in relation to how the how the film adapted it and everything. So I'm going to be a little bit light on the actual review of the teleplay, but I really, really enjoyed it. I thought that it was a pretty fascinating view of military obligation and what it takes to be kind of a member of the military in a sense, and what that takes away from you, and what accountability looks like in terms of creating a sense of duty and honor and upholding that sense of duty and honor. So I am actually going to play a clip from late in the episode that I think sums up the teleplay really well, like sums up the episode really, really well. I'm going to just kind of let this play and hopefully it plays through fine. But this is where Wasnick, I think this is on the eve of the actual, not sentencing, but the resolution of the court case of the court martial. And so he has met with the chaplain of a church where Edward Hall is. And I'm going to play that clip right now.
I'd add this. In the eyes of men, you're guilty of weakness and must stand alone, without honor. But in the eyes of God, your weakness is the weakness of the race of men. And this guilt that shows itself in wars and prison camps and brutality, this guilt you can share with all of us. Oh, you'll bear the cross, the sentence, the stigma, perhaps. But the conscience must rest with your fellow men. For our crime is that though we believe in God, we don't act as if we believed. Your guilt, Captain Hall, is breaking faith in a prison camp. The guilt of men is that there are prison camps.
And that line right there, that line where he says your guilt is breaking in a prison camp and the guilt of men is that there are prison camps, is such a profound, like, thesis statement for this episode, for this entire show, for this entire teleplay. It is such a brilliant and beautifully resonant just like summation of what the morals of the episode are. And that is, and I'll talk about this later in the review of the film, but it's about like that conflict between military duty and what is expected of our soldiers. It's what is expected of our military personnel, and how we treat those who are not able to withstand it or not able to go fully into those expectations. Like someone who is not able to withstand that like level of torment and torture and discomfort and everything is just so at the heart of this entire teleplay. It is at the heart of it, and I think it's something that that Serling's script really explores in a beautiful and very thought-provoking way, because it's not about like, and again, I'm stepping on what Tiny and I are going to talk about in the movie review, but it's not about this patriotic like view of military action or perseverance of the men who fight our wars and everything. It is about the way that we view morality and the way that we view like mental and emotional strength in the face of unimaginable adversity and unimaginable strain, and what we react to when, or how we react to people crumbling under those conditions. And the way that this show paints the military as a a single solitary unit, and how every member of that military is an extension of every other element of the military is so, like, it is such a nuanced take on military life. And it's something I'm going to talk about in the movie review, but it's something that I find so fascinating, is this nuanced approach at it from Serling, and how he is telling this story, not to tell a story about like what happens when someone in the military cracks under pressure, or what happens in the aftermath of that. Or he's not painting Edward Hall Jr. as an enemy combatant. He's not painting him as someone who lost his morality in the face of extreme circumstances in a POW camp. He is painting him as a fallible person, as someone who has only so much that he can give to the fight and give to the military that he has I don't know if it was a draft. I don't know much about the Korean War. I'm so sorry, but he has been basically affiliated with, and he's gone into. One of the things that I did find a little bit, not necessarily disappointing, but I was left wanting, was more exploration of Ed Hall Sr.'s reaction to it. Nicholas Joy, I think, does a great job performing the role in this episode. In particular, the scene where the whiplash scene of him welcoming home his son, and we have that emotional moment where he's welcoming him home, and kind of getting a bead on him and kind of getting a read on him and everything. And then as he goes up to bed, that's when the military guys
I think the judge advocate general people, I don't know, the lawyers, I don't know. But when they come to visit Ed Hall Sr. and they break the news to him that, like, hey, you know, your son is going to be court-martialed for this heinous act. This is the case we have against him. And this is the deal. And then that whiplash scene of Ed Hall Sr. going to his son and saying, like, hey, these are the charges that they're levying against you. Like, what's the deal? Like, what, like, what's wrong? Like, what happened? And what I love about it is the way that Marshall Thompson plays that scene where he admits to it. He says, hey, I'm guilty. Like, I'm guilty of this. And that's like the end of the first act of the episode. And I love that because that positions, that pivots the episode into being about the mental state of Edward Hall Jr. and what he went through. And I think that that is such an interesting, calculated measure in the storytelling that I think just pays off dividends like immediately. It's incredibly nuanced and three-dimensional, and it's really, really satisfying to me. I really enjoyed this episode of television. I thought it was really good. So that's kind of a brief review of the United States Steel Hour episode written by Serling called The Rack, which of course aired April 12th, 1955. Again, it's available on YouTube. I have a link in the show notes to this episode, which are available at anthologypod.com/104. But yeah, that's kind of a brief review of the episode. Yeah, let's bring on Tiny and let's talk about the movie adaptation of it from 1956, starring Paul Newman. And before we get to the review of the Rack film, I'm going to take a quick moment to just remind you that if you like the show, please take a moment to follow me on social media and subscribe to and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, and wherever else you find the podcast. And once again, you can also subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer Podcast's YouTube channel as well for video versions of the podcasts, live streams, and more. And finally, if you'd like to support me and get access to hundreds of exclusive podcast episodes, you can join my Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer, where you can get access to content at any of my tier levels on a recurring monthly subscription basis, which includes a sci-fi only tier, so you get only sci-fi related content on that tier, or you can buy individual collections of recordings a la carte in the Patreon shop section. There are hundreds of exclusive podcast episodes there, ranging from TV and book reviews, movie reaction recordings, commentary tracks, early access to podcast episodes, and a ton more stuff. Again, you can sign up at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. And now back to the show. Okay, and joining me for the second review of the episode is Tiny. Hi, Tiny. Like, to give you a proper introduction, Anthony Ramian of the Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies podcast.
Thank you. Let's keep it professional.
Yes, yes. How is it going, Tiny?
Going good, man. I'm excited to be here. It's been a little while since I've been on an anthology.
It has been. It has been quite a while because that's the thing. I only do like guest episodes when I'm done with the season. And I took my sweet ass time finishing season 3 of The Twilight Zone. so it has been a while. The last time you were on, we talked about 7 days in May, I believe.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. Which was at the end of season 2. That was episode 64 of the podcast. That was way... Oh, my God. That was July 15th, 2020.
Oh, it was that long ago?
That was that long ago. Wow.
I was thinking like 2 years ago. And like, wow.
I kind of was, too. And I'm so sorry it took me this long to finish season 3, you guys. So,
whoa.
Oh, wow. That is nuts. That is nuts. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, how have you been?
I've been good. Yeah, yes. Still doing the other two podcasts. Mm-hmm. And
looking over my notes here, you're on the Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies. Can you tell the audience about those shows? What are they?
I'm sure they know nothing about them. This will be totally new information
yes,
to them. But
not anything I say every five minutes on the podcast.
Right. But OV is our OG podcast.
Indeed.
That's the original one that good old Matt came up with, and I joined him on for talk about movies and TV shows. We talked about this a couple months ago, maybe, when we recorded, but we were kind of reminiscing on some of those early episodes where we did like theme episodes.
Yes.
You know, we totally got away from that, and like, it was a good decision, but those are still fun. Like we look back on them fondly. The Obsessive Viewer is great. That's kind of our flagship podcast there. And then five, six, 7 years after we started that one, we did Tower Junkies, which is our Stephen King podcast.
Oh yes.
And it's all things that serve the King. We talk about not just his books, but the movies, adaptations, spinoffs, the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. We'll probably get to some comic books eventually. That one's really fun too. We've kind of had that one on the back burner for a little while too.
So
those are our two other podcasts, and I'm on them not as often as I'd like to be, but you know, still there, still in the you know, floating around in the head all the time thinking about two podcasts.
Oh yes. And I mean, they sound incredible. Like, what, where could you find these podcasts?
You can find them anywhere you get podcasts. Nice. Any podcatcher you use. Yeah.
Nice. Nice. You know, it's funny, 'cause like, not to make this all of inside baseball thing or whatever, but like, yeah, I love doing all of the podcasts, obviously. And like, I know, like with Obsessive Viewer, I've been doing it weekly now since November, which is a big deal. Like, I've released like 25 episodes in 25 weeks. Wow. And yeah, it's nuts. It's insane. And like, it's crazy. But yeah, definitely check that out though, if you haven't already, obsessiveviewer.com. But yeah, with Tower Junkies, it's a little bit touch and go there and everything. But like, I know that I haven't had a chance to chat with you on really any of the podcasts recently, 'cause we've all been busy and everything. So I'm very glad that you were able to carve out time to talk Rod Serling and The Rack on Anthology. And I'm looking forward to chatting with you on Obsessive Viewer at some point in the future, whenever our schedules line up.
Sure. Yeah. You've been kind of killing it on the social media lately, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Your little edits and stuff. I like the, where you like take a clip from a movie and you kind of like analyze it or talk about it. The 28 Days Later one was really cool. And I actually really like the Sunshine one, 'cause you like broke down elements of the scene and stuff like that. Those are cool little videos you made, man. Those are cool.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Inside baseball for that. Cause why not? That's something that I've been working on, like just to get the podcasts out there and everything. I've been like dabbling in like TikToks and like YouTube shorts and Facebook and Instagram reels and stuff. What I do is like, when I have time, like on the weekends, like this weekend is going to be a big weekend, 'cause I'm actually, taking PTO on Friday, and just for a personal day, just to do podcast stuff. But like what I do when I have time and no social life is I will put together like 10 TikTok videos, schedule them out, schedule the Instagram reels, schedule the Facebook reels, schedule the YouTube shorts. And it got to a point, and like, this is inside baseball, and I'm sorry, check the show notes for timestamps if you want to skip over this, but, with like the 28 Days Later clip and the Sunshine clip, I like intentionally had the idea that, and this is going to reflect very poorly on me, I was like, you know, I'm not going to say that I'm putting a lot of work into these videos, because I'm really not. Like, me putting clips together is fine, because like that's stuff that's already been produced on the podcast. Me recording videos, it's like I'm literally spending 2 minutes recording a video and then I'm editing it together to make it like put a backdrop on it and stuff. It's low effort content, to be honest. But like the 28 Days Later and the Sunshine stuff, that was like an intentional, like it started with me thinking like I could just put a clip of a movie out there and then maybe it'll gain traction. I'll gain some new followers. Like just do like the most shitpost level of content imaginable. And even then I was like, I can't do it. Like I need to at least say something about like, oh, this scene from Sunshine where they're looking at Mercury passing over in front of the sun. Like, I need to comment on it because it's one of my favorite movies and I want to comment on it. And like, lo and behold, that like actually got a bit, it kind of ate shit on TikTok, but on YouTube shorts, like it got like 4,000 views and I was like, oh wow, okay. So I might be doing more stuff like that.
Like I could totally see one of those going viral.
Because
that's what's popular. Like it felt like a reel. Like that's what's big on all those platforms now is people
absolutely
want short. And I fall under that camp too. Like something that's short and satisfying, digestible, analyzation of a fun scene. Like that's I could totally see that getting a bunch of views. That's awesome. I didn't know that it was that popular. That's great.
Yeah, and like I said, not to flex or anything, but it did get like almost 5,000 views on YouTube Shorts. And like, I mean, look, guys, it got me an extra 5 subscribers on YouTube. So,
hey,
I've put in my 2 weeks' notice at my day job, I'm ready to commit to content full time.
nice.
But no, and I'm pretty sure like maybe 2 or 3 of those 5 subscribers have already unsubscribed. But anyway, subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer Podcast YouTube channel. But it is kind of a little bit disheartening because I do know that short form content is what would catch fire on like those social media platforms. Meanwhile, I'm releasing like with Obsessive Viewer, like everything that I do is like I'm doing twice as much work than I need to do. So like the weekly podcast, The Obsessive Viewer, because I'm an idiot, I'm like, I'm going to review 2 movies each week. And that means trying to get a guest or a co-host for one or both reviews, or like just doing a solo double review, which I'm fine with. But it's interesting because this week, like as of this being released, yesterday on Obsessive Viewer, I released an episode where I reviewed Civil War and Late Night with the Devil. And Late Night with the Devil, I recorded with Mike. I recorded that a week ago on the Eclipse Day on April 8th. That's the secondary review. And Civil War, I recorded last night with Brandon for that part of it. And I put it together, edited it together. It's all one episode, almost 3 hours long. So that's something. So anyway, that's all to say. Check out Obsessive Viewer and Tower Jerkies.
Totally. So
yeah, but anyway, I don't know how to transition out of this. So thank you, Tiny, for the compliments and everything. And tonight we are in the second half of this because, like I do with Obsessive Viewer, this is the same thing. I don't know why I'm so like attached to doing like 2 reviews an episode because I do the same with regular anthology episodes. But in this second review of the evening, we are talking about The Rack, which is the 1956 film adaptation of the teleplay by Rod Serling that was on the U.S. Steel Hour in 1955, which I have already reviewed on this episode. But the film adaptation came out in 1956. It is available to watch, to rent, and buy. I think it's available to rent, but it is definitely available to buy on Vudu/Fandango at home. And before we get into kind of our thoughts on it, I'm going to run through the cast and everything, if you don't mind indulging me, Tiny.
Sure.
Okay. So we will be spoiling the movie, probably. I'm not going to bother with like a spoiler, non-spoiler, since I've already reviewed the teleplay. But the premise, according to IMDb, is a decorated Korean War hero inexplicably collaborates with the enemy while interred in a POW camp and is court-martialed. The director was Arnold Lavin, who I didn't get his background on that, sorry. But writer for it was Stuart Stern, adapted from Serling's teleplay, of course. This was his only time working with or adjacent to Serling, so he didn't work on Twilight Zone or Night Gallery or anything like that. However, a notable credit of his is that he, I think, co-wrote the screenplay, or maybe he just wrote the screenplay for Rebel Without a Cause, which you and I and our friend Ben reviewed in episode 366 of The Obsessive Viewer. Yeah. And so the cast, running down the cast, we've got Paul Newman. He plays Captain Edward W. Hall Jr. His other collaborations with Serling, he had one where in December of 1954, he appeared in an episode of Danger, which was written by Serling. The episode was titled Knife in the Dark. It's interesting. The plot summary for that is prison inmate Jeff had his best friend murdered by the sadistic Willie. To save himself, Jeff tells the warden he didn't do it. So that's pretty interesting. I didn't look up to see if that's available online anywhere. But I believe it was one of those like live teleplay anthology series, like stage production things. And then as Sam Moulton is Wendell Corey, who he was also in the Rack TV episode. Walter Pigeon plays Edward Hall Sr. This is his only collaboration with Serling. And then we've also got Edmund O'Brien, who appeared in 7 Days in May, which you and I reviewed in Anthology episode 64. And he also appeared in the Playhouse 90 teleplay The Comedian, which I covered in episode 30 of the podcast. And his other collaboration with Serling was a 1966 TV movie titled The Doomsday Flight, which was written by Serling. And then running down the rest of the cast, just real quick, we've got Anne Francis as Aggie Hall. She appeared in 2 Twilight Zone episodes. Those two were The After Hours and Jess Bell. We've also got Lee Marvin, who appeared also in 2 episodes of The Twilight Zone, The Grave and Steel. And then we've also got Cloris Leachman, who appeared in 2 Twilight Zones. One original Twilight Zone, It's a Good Life, and its sequel in the 2000s, It's Still a Good Life. She also appeared in Mr. Finchley versus the Bomb, which was an episode of the Kaiser Aluminum Hour in 1956, written by Serling. She also appeared in one segment of Night Gallery in 1972. And the final two pieces of cast is James Best, who appeared in 3 Twilight Zones, including The Grave, The Last Rites of Jeff Myrtlebank, and Jess Bell. And rounding out the cast, we've got Barry Atwater, who appeared in 1 episode of The Twilight Zone, one of my personal favorites, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. He also appeared in the Night Gallery pilot in a 1973 episode of Night Gallery titled The Doll of Death. Okay, so that is the cast and crew rundown. Tiny, are you still awake?
I am here, buddy.
Nice, nice. yeah, so let's dive in to the rack. Once again, we are going to be filtering in and out with spoilers. So fair warning, we're going to be potentially spoiling this movie. So Tiny, I enlisted you to watch the rack. How did you feel about it when you watched it? How'd you feel about the rack? And we should also note that you haven't seen the TV episode.
Right. Yeah, I wasn't able to squeeze that one in. But I really enjoyed the movie. I went into it not really knowing anything about it at all, other than Paul Newman's in it. Mm-hmm. So I really loved it. It's classic Rod Serling. He holds a mirror up to society and says, "Hey, this is part of our society. Is this right? Or how do we feel about this?" Or any number of commentaries on, the zeitgeist or societal mm-hmm. norms or abnorms, and this totally does that. I think the context of when this film was made, the backdrop of the Korean War, it was filmed in 1956. The war was still super fresh on everyone's mind. This is a time where, people still felt a certain way about military service and how psychology relates to military service. And, it was still kind of mysterious, but maybe we were learning more. And this movie touches on that idea. And it ultimately has kind of a progressive approach to it. I think it's kind of cliche to say, but it was kind of ahead of its time, I think. Mm-hmm. And that was really fun to watch and just fascinating. I think to be our age in 1956, how would we feel about this? Like, mm-hmm. would we, given again, the societal attitudes towards psychiatry and how it relates to military service and what a person can endure, like the opinions on that, how would we have felt back then? Like, I think I'm sure you and I probably feel a certain way about how this person was treated in this movie. Mm-hmm. but it's because we're alive in 2024. You know, we have our opinions 70 years after this movie was made. It's just so fun to think about that. Think about the societal implications of that, and it really gets your gears turning. And that's what's awesome about Rod Serling's writing.
I wholeheartedly agree. Obviously, like, I'm such just a fan of Rod Serling's writing, obviously. But yeah, it's so interesting because I watched the TV episode first and then watched the movie. And something that struck me about both, and I'm sure I bring this up in the TV review as well, but like, it's just the way that Serling, like what I found really interesting is that the script follows the Serling teleplay pretty closely. It expands on it because it's a longer work, obviously. But it still captures, it still keeps that level of social commentary and that unique position that Serling has in that first iteration of it. And by that, I mean, like, his background, obviously, Rod Serling, he was in World War II in the Pacific Theater. He saw just horrendous things. Like, he was very affected by it, obviously. And that really filtered a lot into his writing. And that's something I really appreciate about The Rack, is that it's not this like jingoistic, like hoorah, like American military might, American strength. It is diving deeper into that psychological effects of war, psychological effects of what a person can endure. And it also, it doesn't paint a picture, it doesn't paint it as like military bad, human individuality good. It has these layers to it where it's like, yeah, we're going to court-martial this soldier not only because he collaborated with the enemy, but because of the bigger implications of it, that, yeah, what does this mean for the military? Like, the entire, like, meaning of military, if one member of the military crumbles under this pressure, like, that creates such a whirlpool of, like, a leak within the military machine that, like, if one person isn't punished for not being able to withstand something, what does that mean for people who are going to be withstanding these things or encountering these things going forward in future conflicts? Like, there's just a big macro viewpoint of what it means for the military and for the military industrial complex and all of these other, like, things that I found just so riveting because as an a-hole millennial guy, like, I just kind of, even so far into this project that I'm doing with Anthology, where I am steeping myself in classic television, classic science fiction, classic social commentary, I still find it so interesting when I'm watching art that's made so far in the past that is as progressive as it is and as forward thinking and as three-dimensionally thought out, in multifaceted. And it isn't just like a propaganda piece for the military or anything, which is probably a naive position to come to the work from on my part, but it's nonetheless just really interesting when I see that nuance. And it's surprising because of the context of when it was made, but it's not surprising given the pedigree of the author of the work being Rod Serling. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why my favorite, one of the more interesting characters in the film is the one played by Wendell Corey, mm-hmm. the Major Sam Moulton. He's like basically the prosecutor.
Yep.
I love the way it was set up because early on in the movie, before the trial starts and all that, he's very reluctant. He has a personal opinion about how this needs to be handled, but he's also a soldier who's going to do his duty. And I really love his approach, the character's approach early on in the movie, where he calls him into his office and says, "Hey, you're going to be court-martialed. he's very professional with them, and he's like, hey, you know, this, I'm being, trying to be courteous to you. And I think he, in a roundabout way, says, you know, without coming out and saying it, he says, you know, I understand what you did. I you're a human being, and the army is asking you not to be a human being, and that's not fair. And I don't really, I think he conveyed that he's very reluctant to prosecute him, but again, he has a job to do. And I loved the understanding between both of them in that scene. And then, of course, you get to the trial, and he's a completely different person. He's just, he's in prosecutor, laser beam, take this guy down mode. And he, I mean, he fucking takes him to task. Like, there's a point later on in the movie where I'm like, how is this not leading the witness? How is this not kind of badgering the witness a little bit? But maybe a military tribunal is different, or whatever. A military trial is different. Maybe they have different rules. But I was watching some of it, and I was like, why aren't the judges jumping in here? Or like, why isn't someone objecting here? This is kind of rough. But it was also very dramatic. So, but yeah, that was, I think that that character kind of exemplifies the attitude, or maybe the general kind of feel of, hey, this is a tricky situation here. I like that.
Oh, absolutely. And the performances overall are just incredible. Like, Paul Newman, obviously, dude's amazing.
Yes.
But like you said, Wendell Corey is fantastic as well. A little piece of trivia that is not meant to derail anything, so I apologize. But a piece of trivia is that the for the sci-fi fans, Walter Pidgeon and Anne Francis are both in this movie as father-in-law and daughter-in-law. So we've got Anne Francis plays Aggie Hall, and then of course Walter Pidgeon plays Edward Hall Sr. They both appeared as father and daughter in the classic sci-fi film from 1956, Forbidden Planet. So pretty interesting, mildly interesting, but but that's something that I can't, so I'm not entirely sure. I could be mistaken. I'm pretty sure I'm not mistaken, because I think it's in both things, but something that I really latched onto about this movie and this story is that the way it's presented, and I'm sure I will have said this before in my episode review, but the way it's presented where Edward Hall Jr. just like, it's not presented as a mystery. It's not like this military mystery thing where it's like, well, did he collaborate with the enemy? Did he do this? Instead, it's like, yeah, I did it. I'm going to cop to it. Like, it's not a did he or did he not. It's not a question of did he break under torture or under duress or anything. It's like, yeah, he did. Like, he's upfront about it. And then it's more just about like what should be expected of soldiers when they are in this situation. Like, what should be expected of them? And like, is there really a punishment for someone not being able to withstand something that grave and mentally and physically and emotionally taxing and torturous.
Yeah, for sure. So, and I think, just to kind of, this probably isn't necessary, but to qualify it, you know, I always feel a little hesitant to comment on anything military, because it's like, I'm a big believer in experience. And, you know, if you haven't experienced something, you really don't know. And I'd never served in the military. And so I remember when, Serial podcast, their second season, they talked about the whole Bo Bergdahl thing. And I was listening to that podcast, and I was like, man, people just lit this guy up. Like, they were just like, he's a traitor, he deserves to be killed. And like, I mean, he's like all this horrible. I'm like, man, the guy was suffering in a POW. He was a POW for like a year or whatever, and he was held in a cage. This guy suffered, and like, he, you know, but I didn't serve in the military. I can't relate to how they feel having someone abandon their post like he did. And like, I don't know. I wanted to say that, like, I think it's easy to kind of sit back and look at this as civilians, if you will. But, I think this movie kind of wants to appeal to civilians as well. Like, I think, you know, it's not, I think the movie's asking anyone who sees it to think about this, right? It's not, trying to get anyone to shy away from thinking about what this means and the implications of it, kind of like you were talking about before. Mm-hmm. So I don't, obviously I don't think we're wrong to do that. I'm just saying, I feel like there's an element that people who weren't in the military can't always relate to or can't always take into consideration when it comes to something like this. And it's interesting to think about, and it's kind of a qualification you have to throw out there, I guess, when you're going to comment on it, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, for the record, I've never served in the military. I do not have, I have never once had the physical or mental acumen to be a worthy candidate to even be considered to go to the military. Like, that's just, that is a level of person, like that is a level of skill that I will never have. Like, I could never do the military. But I do respect anyone who can just go in and do that. But but what I do like about it, kind of going back to the storytelling of this, is that it's not necessarily painting the military as, you know, the bad guy. It's not a clear cut, like, black and white. Oh, it's black and white, but it's not a clear cut, you know, like dual, I don't know, construct of good and bad. Because it is showing that more three-dimensional view of both military, just the military culture and the military machinations of it in the system of military, while also kind of having this battle of showcasing the humanity of Edward Hall and his capacity for withstanding what he withstood in the prison camp in Korea. Like, having it, it's more about who he is as an individual, which I find so interesting, because so much of what I understand of the military, and from pop culture and from knowing people in the military and who have served and everything, it's like the entire construct of it is to break down the people in the military to be a unit that is able to work as one cohesive unit. And when one part of that breaks down, or it throws a wrench in everything. I don't know if that word salad right. made much sense.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah. So I just really appreciate that it went that far with it.
Another thing that jumped out to me, more creatively, is the Aggie Hall character. I feel like Rod Serling is really good at, he was really good at writing women. And he was not afraid to make a female character the star of a episode or whatever. I'm thinking back to like the 16mm Shrine and the Hitchhiker, those are episodes of the Twilight Zone that have female stars, and they're not just like somebody's mom or like someone's wife, you know, like they're you know, like he had actual characters for women to play. And I feel like Aggie Hall, the character played by Anne Francis, you know, she's a widow, so I mean that's that's an aspect of it, but I think she had a lot to work with, and she was great. Like like you were talking about performances earlier, everybody crushed their performances.
Oh, absolutely.
They were all great, but she was one of the standouts to me. I thought she was fantastic. I love the way that she was. I think the easy route would have been like she kind of falls in love with Paul Newman's character or something like that.
Right.
But that wasn't even on the table. Like, no one was thinking that. Like, it was, you know, so it just plays and addresses to the creativity of the writing in the movie. But yeah, I think it was interesting to see how she wasn't like just a pretty girl, or, you know, she was actually engaging with what the main character, what Edward Hall Jr. was going through, and like was trying to console him. She was there for him, and, you know, she was a character who contributed to the narrative of the story. She wasn't just there, you know. I just appreciated that about the movie and the writing.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and that's one of the things that I kind of, so like, with this movie, like it is adapted from Serling's script, and obviously it's expanded upon in a few places. One of the things I didn't find, I wasn't as kind of into with the original teleplay, was the Aggie Hall character and Edward Hall Sr. I felt like they were slightly, like I wanted, it's not that they were underserved in the original teleplay, but it's that I wanted more. I wanted more of their, like how they kind of internalize what happens and what's going on and everything. And I got that from the movie. I feel like they expanded that pretty well. And I think they got really strong performances from Walter Pidgeon and Anne Francis as well. Like, there's a lot of good, like, quiet moments with her and with Edward Hall Sr. as well, that I feel like really, really helped mold the overall story, that they were doing. So it's a good, expansion from the original teleplay, in my opinion, that I think worked really well.
For sure.
Yeah. I had something on my mic. So, oh. but yeah, let's see. What else do you have in mind about this? Oh, I do have some trivia if we don't have really much else to say about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Just one real piece of trivia is that from IMDb, no, I think this is from Wikipedia, but it's cited. The film was based on an episode of the United States Steel Hour, obviously. Let's see, screenwriter. Oh, so the director and screenwriter had been pushing for Paul Newman to be cast in the film after seeing him in other productions, but MGM's chief of production was opposed to it. So they gave screen tests and they were kind of bouncing around ideas. They wanted Leslie Nielsen for the role. Glenn Ford was also offered the role. But what I find interesting about that is that the quote is that Glenn Ford declined the role, saying that he would never want to play a, quote, Rat Fink role. And it said that other actors declined for the same reason, which I find so interesting because I think that that's an interesting reflection of how progressive this movie is and how progressive it is to the point where it seemed somewhat alienating from actors in Hollywood, because this is a time where it as progressive as the movie is, or as forward thinking as it is, or even as nuanced as it was, I feel like there was still, judging from that quote and from the idea that multiple actors declined for the same reason, there was this idea that, you know, this character is, they view him two-dimensionally, like as someone who is like a rat, who is someone who has done the unthinkable, who has done something that is unforgivable. And I find that so interesting because the movie paints him in such a way that he is sympathetic, but also he's not off the hook from it or anything, but he is a tortured person, both in the aftermath of his actual torture and in actually being tortured. I just find it so interesting that those layers exist in the finished product, but the actors that were in line for the role didn't want it because they didn't want, presumably they didn't want to play with those layers. I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting.
That is really interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And I don't really have any other notes, except I will say, another piece of trivia is that the original teleplay, quote from trivia from IMDb, the original teleplay writer Rod Serling liked the film adaptation, but he felt the film version could and should have shown some of the POW camp in flashbacks. And then he said that he did feel that the scene with the father and son alone was better written in the film version than in his original teleplay. Do you think the movie would have benefited from flashbacks to the actual camp sequences? Or were you fine with it being strictly like courtroom drama after the fact?
I prefer that. I'm glad that they did it the way they did. I think
nice.
I think it would have just gotten, I think it would have been a distraction, and mm-hmm. I think it also made it more made it more like the audience watching the movie is like a member of the jury. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And we're like, because, you know, we don't have the actual, again, kind of experience of seeing what happened and getting all those details. We have to go by his accounts and other people's accounts of what happened, just like a real courtroom and like, yep, a real trial. I think that kind of gave it a little bit of a level of authenticity that made it pretty interesting in my book.
I would have to absolutely agree, not to besmirch the opinion of Mr. Rod Serling by any stretch, but I do feel that, like, I feel that if they would have included any like flashbacks or like POW sequences in the movie, I feel like that would have been, I don't know if it necessarily would have made it a more sensationalized story or more or a less grounded drama, but I think that the potential for it to be for it to detract from the grounded storytelling would have been there, and it would have been a lot. It would have been very hard for the film to navigate away from being like a sensationalized viewpoint of it, like, because the movie strikes such a strong balance between, like you said, us be like the audience being like jurors ourselves, like being kind of witness to the court proceedings and learning about the experience of Edward Hall and what happened through the actual court system, the court martial system, as opposed to actually seeing it in flashbacks. I think that would have really been detrimental to the more grounded story being told. So, yeah. So I think we're in agreement there.
Yeah, totally.
Yep. So I think that is just about it that we've got for The Rack. Any other thoughts that we didn't touch on this movie, Tiny?
I kind of, just real quick, mm-hmm, I liked the ending. I liked how it was like, mm-hmm, I feel like there could have been like more of a denouement, but then I also like the, yeah, idea that it kind of stuck to sort of a trial format. Like, mm-hmm, this is what it was decided, and that's final. Like, there's no sense in trying to think about this anymore because the sentence has been, you know, I mean, it's been decided. This is what happened. This is how they ruled, and, yep, you're done. And that's the harsh reality of a trial. And so I kind of appreciated the ending. Like, at first I was like, oh man, I was kind of hoping for a little more meat on that bone, but I was, sure, like, it kind of makes sense. I think it needed to be an abrupt thing like that. But that's another thing that kind of jumped out. But yeah. Yeah, really good.
Yeah, me too. And that's kind of basically how the episode ends as well. The TV episode ends. I do like that abruptness of it, and the fact that it's not a good ending for the character. Like, it's not. I mean, he's found guilty. It's a very difficult thing to watch, because by that point we know what he's gone through. We know what the pieces of it are. We know that it's not a clear-cut, like, good bad situation. It's just a very difficult position to be in, a very difficult situation that he was in and that the military was in prosecuting him and court-martialing him. And for it to end that way is, it's a downer. It's like, it's a bit of a downer, and it's something that I don't know, it's something that the abruptness really helps hammer at home just how kind of, I don't want to say it's bleak necessarily, but it's kind of bleak.
Yeah,
it's kind of just a downer ending, and we're left to kind of infer what comes next for everyone involved.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Yep. Of course, you can watch The Rack on Vudu or on digital anywhere. I think it's just available to rent or buy on all the digital platforms, I believe. Tiny, what did you end up rating this on Letterboxd?
What did I give it? Actually, you know, I don't remember. I think I gave it like at least 4 stars. Let me look. It was like, maybe I watched like a month ago.
Yeah.
hang on, where's my diary? I gave it 3.5 stars.
Nice. As did I. We both gave it 3.5 stars. Yeah, and it's very, very solid. Do you remember anything about 7 Days in May and how it compares to this? Like, if I can throw that wrench at you completely.
I'm trying to remember 7 days in May.
Yeah, it was more of a political thriller where it was a U.S. Army colonel alerts the president of a planned military coup against him. I rated it 4 stars and you rated it a number of stars that are escaping me right now because I can't find it.
That's right. Was it Kirk Douglas?
Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas. Yep. Ava Gardner.
Yeah.
Edmund O'Brien, of course, as I said before, Martin Balsam.
Yeah. That one was good. I think maybe I liked that one a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
A little more thrillerish. Mm-hmm. A little more production value to that one, but yeah.
More suspenseful and yeah, I totally get that. Right. Yeah. Right. I'm trying to find if you actually even, okay. Yes. You rated it 4 stars. There we go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. That works out.
Yep. There we go.
I'm not crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, we can kind of wind things down a little bit here. Tiny, where can people find you and your shows? It was The Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies. Is that it? Where can we find you online and those shows?
Those shows can be found again. You can download them on any podcatcher. You can go to ovpodcast.com, go to the website. Mm-hmm. Matt has some writing on there as well. That's really good.
Thank you.
And powerjunkiespod.com, that's the other one, right?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And what's coming what's coming next on those shows, Tiny? If I can put you on the spot.
Yeah, on Obsessive Viewer, I'm not sure, haven't been on it for a while. We're kind of flirting with some ideas for Tower Junkies.
Yes.
Spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. My wife and I have a baby on the way, and so,
I was wondering if you were going to announce it. Wow. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm willing to say it because I think everything's going to work out. I think we're going to get there. But
nice.
So we got a baby on the way. So I'm kind of like not committing to things.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I've had people asking me to do stuff like be on stuff like around town and stuff. And I'm like, I can't commit to anything right now. We've kind of floated in a couple ideas for Tower Junkies that we might be jumping on here soon.
You know, and yes, 100%. And, you know, I've got to say, now that you've said it, this is inside baseball and everything. When we were talking privately and you said like, you know, I'll have some time, like at this certain point, maybe we can do this with Tower Junkies. And like, I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And like, I just want you to hear it now that like, it's fine if that doesn't happen, because I know that your life is about to change. Like, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm so gung-ho to do that in that time frame that you said, but I'm like, Tiny, like, it's okay, yeah. Like, it's all right.
I might be fooling myself a little bit on that one. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, but I'm so glad that you announced it here. So I'm very obviously we've talked and everything. I'm so unbelievably thrilled for you and Paige. I'm so excited. So yeah,
thanks, buddy. Yeah, we're getting there. We're excited.
Yeah, yeah. So more news to come. I'm gonna convert Obsessive Viewer into just Tiny, you know, baby watch podcast. So I'll be commenting on everything about the new parenthood life of Tiny in the weeks to come. That sounds so creepy. I'm so sorry. But
a
no.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. I think if anyone listening wants to congratulate Tiny, they obviously can like reach out to Tiny. Like, what would be the best way to reach out to you on social media, by the way? Because I know you're not really on social media that much.
I don't do the Twitter thing, or X, whatever the hell it's called. Yeah. Best way to reach me would be actually probably on Letterboxd.
Nice.
At Obsessive Tiny on Letterboxd, yeah.
Nice.
I haven't been logging a lot of stuff on there lately, but yeah.
Well, you've also been very busy with volunteer work and baby preparation stuff, so yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah.
the best way to congratulate Tiny and to support Tiny is of course to listen to Obsessive Viewer and Tower Junkies and Anthology, even though he's on once a season on Anthology. That'll do it for this episode of Anthology, I guess. Follow Tiny on Letterboxd at Obsessive Tiny. Follow me on Letterboxd at Obsessive Viewer. Once again, if you like the show, please take a moment to follow me on all the social medias and subscribe to and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, wherever else you find the show. And once again, you can also subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer Podcast's YouTube channel as well for video versions of the podcasts, live streams, and more. The video version of this is going to be up on the YouTubes the next week, after listening to this. And speaking of next week, next week on the show, I am starting season 4 of The Twilight Zone, the infamous hour-long episode season. I'm kicking it off with episode 1, In His Image. And the bonus review is going to be for Science Fiction Theater season 2, episode 5, When a Camera Fails. So stay tuned for that. That should be up next Friday from when you're listening to this. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Check out the other shows, Obsessive Viewer, Tower Junkies, and the YouTube channel and TikTok and all of that. Tiny, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Anthology. And congratulations officially on air.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Yep. And now, enjoy this short clip from a recent Patreon-exclusive episode. For the full episode and more Patreon-exclusive content, sign up at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Maybe I'm being a little bit too hard on it, but it just feels so lazy and contrived when it all plays out. Now, the actual encounter with the mule, I understand, like I've said before, I've only read the first book in the Foundation series, so I don't know anything about the mule. I don't know what the mule is to the series and everything. My understanding is that he's a pretty big, you know, character. And this made me interested. This has gotten my curiosity. I like the idea of Gale having a vision of the future and seeing that, like having this brief encounter. As kind of hokey and bland as the kind of future destruction visualization is, that encounter with the mule is pretty interesting. It is interesting the way that he talks about how she has a following and stuff, and she has like minions or whatever. Thank you for listening to Anthology, a Twilight Zone and classic science fiction podcast presented by obsessiveviewer.com. This episode was produced and edited by me, Matt Hurt. If you have feedback, thoughts on our episodes, or just want to connect, you can email me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. For more information on this show, including a full archive of our episodes and show notes, visit anthologypod.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please give us a follow on social media and subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice so you never miss an episode. Also, consider rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Audible to help increase our visibility and grow our community. If you want to support the show and get early access to new episodes, as well as a steady stream of exclusive episodes, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. For information on more podcasts presented by obsessiveviewer.com, visit obsessiveviewer.com/podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Get up to 2 months of free podcasting service with Libsyn. Check out the show notes for your promo code to get started podcasting today.